Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is Season 1, Episode 2. Hello, and thank you for listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota, and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, Director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I will be interviewing Professor Mary Jo Kane, the founder and first director of the Tucker Center. Dr. Kane is a professor in the School of Kinesiology and is an internationally recognized scholar. As many of you know, she's published extensively on media representations of women's sport and is the recipient of the first endowed chair in the nation and perhaps in the world related to women's sport. Professor Kane is also a fellow in the National Academy of Kinesiology. She's a renowned scholar and multiple award winner for many institutions. And over the past three decades, her scholarship, teaching, mentoring, and community outreach have certainly shaped and changed the landscape for sportswomen. And her contributions throughout have influenced countless stakeholders, myself included, who advocate for gender equity. So I hope you will enjoy a woman who has lived the mission of the Tucker Center of making a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport. Welcome, Professor Mary Jo Kane and my colleague.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for that most generous introduction, Dr. Lavoie.
You're very welcome, Dr. Kane. Some of you may know and some of you may not that I've known Dr. Kane for over 20 plus years before as a graduate student and later as a colleague and now as the director who follows in her quite large footsteps in the Tucker Center. So, Mary Jo, tell us, for those listeners who don't know, how did the Tucker Center come to be? Because a lot of people don't know the origin story of the Tucker Center.
It was 1992, which was the 20th anniversary of Title IX here in the United States. And girls in participation, girls' rates of participation in sport and physical activity from highly recreational to highly professional was blowing through the roof. And after decades of being told that girls weren't interested in sports or certainly wouldn't be any good if they played sports, Title IX put that myth forever to rest. But as a scholar and an educator in a major research university like the University of Minnesota and one of the scholars in the country doing work on sport and gender, I was very concerned that we as scholars and educators were not keeping pace with what the impact of this participation meant from exercise science to the social sciences, which is my area. So I had this notion that what we needed is to have housed inside a major research university the first ever center that took seriously as an academic enterprise what it meant to study academically and get evidence-based research on what this impact meant. Again, I had just gotten tenure. I was in a faculty meeting in the School of Kinesiology here at the university, and a development officer came in and asked if any faculty were interested in any topics or thoughts that might interest a prospective donor. And I raised my hand and quite naively, frankly, changed the course of certainly my career. I told him what I just mentioned to you, Dr. Lavoie, and he thought that was a good idea. And in the meantime, he was off to a development officers conference in San Antonio, Texas. He went into the database of the College of Education, and he found the name of a woman named Dorothy Tucker, who was a 1945 graduate of our department. And he met with her and found out that her husband had just died. She had no children. She cared a great deal about sports, especially golf, and she was very wealthy. So he shared with her my idea. He asked me to put down on a 2 to 3 page proposal my vision and my passion to create a center, thinking nothing would ever happen. I sent it out into the universe. She read it. She liked it, but she wanted to be a pioneer. And so she asked this development officer if it was true, because this was something I certainly emphasized in my proposal, that if she gave money to a major research university, would she be a pioneer? And I said somewhat sarcastically, but it was also true, that if she gave more than $50 to study simply and only the impact of sport and physical activity in the lives of girls and women, she would be a pioneer. Fast forward a few weeks later, this development officer named David Madsen called me in my office. He asked me if I was sitting down, and he asked me that because he said, this woman, her name is Dorothy Tucker, she's done her homework. She would indeed be a pioneer because there's nothing out there anywhere like your vision, Dr. Kane. And she's decided to give money to start the center. And I said, how much money? And he said, well, that's why I'm asking you if you're sitting down. And I remembered, Nicole, thinking at the time, oh my God, this woman has given us $50,000 and no one will ever believe this remarkable story.
Yeah, we'll be set for life.
Yeah, well, it is a remarkable story, but yeah. She didn't give $50,000. She gave $1 million to start the center. And that was just an extraordinary moment in my career, certainly, and the beginning of what has been an incredible journey.
Yeah, and that's around 1993 when the Tucker Center first opened its doors. When I was just beginning my coaching career at Wellesley College, and as I was looking to the future and knowing the Tucker Center was opening its doors, and I became really interested in the scholarly study of gender and sport, it made a lot of sense for me to come back and study under you and in the Tucker Center. And lo and behold, it was the right decision. And here we are 27 years later.
Yes, and just so that the listeners know, I agreed to become the department chair in the School of Kinesiology, but I did so with the understanding and the promise that I would be able to hire someone to do a national search to bring someone back to basically run the center while I was, or at least do a significant part of running the center while I was the department chair. And I was therefore given the task of hiring somebody, and we cast a wide net, but at the end of the day, and one of the best hires I've certainly ever made, both in terms of being in the Tucker Center and as the director, was to hire Dr. Lavoie to come back and run the center. And she has taken us to heights and audiences, including something like this podcast, that I would never have ever dreamed of.
Well, Dr. Kane, you certainly do a lot of podcasts for other people, so it's kind of fun that we get to do our own podcast for Tucker Center Talks.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you for inviting me. This is just really, it's like a dream. It's wonderful.
Of course. So we get asked a lot what the Tucker Center does, and our threefold mission is research, education, and outreach. But in your opinion, what do you think that we're best known for? What's the Tucker Center best known for?
I think that we're best known, frankly, for producing high quality work, whether it is in the area of conducting groundbreaking, cutting edge research that is accessible to a broader audience than just simply an academic one. I certainly think that all of our educational initiatives that we've embarked on have also been terribly important, because we have thought from day one that our audience is beyond the halls of the academy, and that we want to get our research and our educational initiatives and, frankly, our community service out to a variety of stakeholders, from policymakers to college and university presidents to the girls and women themselves, to their parents, to national and international organizations that are advocates for women's sports and for breaking down barriers and providing opportunities for girls and women to participate. So, I, because we remain the first and only, we have had this unique platform to get out the kinds of things that we do. And because we are very targeted in terms of the kinds of audiences that we want to attract, I think that's really what we have done best, and in many ways, what I'm most proud of.
Well, it certainly has been fun in the 15 years that I've been here as your colleague to see how our research and our products and our programming has grown, and how colleagues around the country have been accessing our reports and our scholarship and our infographics and our social media. And I think, you know, what's the foundation of the Tucker Center is when you founded it, is that you did high quality, impactful, cutting edge research, and that you're best known for sort of the seminal paper, your continuum paper, your sport as a challenging the gender binary paper. Can you tell the listeners who might not be familiar with that paper how that sort of set you down this path and really put the Tucker Center on the map? So what is it, and what is it its impact been?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. And this is a piece that I wrote in 1995. But before that, I just want to do a quick follow-up to the question that you asked me before. I think the other reason why we've been incredibly impactful is because we have a really fabulous website, which I take zero credit for. Well, that's not true. The only credit I take for it is that I've hired people like you and Jonathan and our graduate students, who, by the way, come from all over the country to do a dissertation or a thesis on some aspect related to girls and women's sports. And the other piece of that is, as Dr. Lavoie knows, we have been fundraisers for specific initiatives or to support scholarships and fellowships. And I think we're great stewards of those who believe in us and who give money to fund what we do. And that too is reflected in our social media presence and in our website. So at the risk of being a shameless promoter, go to tuckercenter.org. And I say that because everything that we have, from our work with the local public television station, where we've produced 3 award-winning documentaries, to every distinguished lecture that we've given over the years, to all of our research reports, all of those are downloadable for free. And everything we do is free and open to the public because, again, it is so important for us to get this work out.
Yeah, and I think weekly, I mean, you and I get emails all the time of people asking us, you know, what does the data say about X or Y? And we can just point them right to our website and say, we have it right here. And we've done this work precisely for this reason, because people need it and want it.
Exactly.
So yeah, let's go back to your continuum paper, because I think that is such an important piece of work and is still relevant today as it was when you wrote it in the 90s.
Yeah, I think so. This began with me thinking about the whole notion of this thing called a gender gap, and how lots of scholars, well-meaning and well-intentioned scholars, including people like myself, talked about how, because of Title IX and because there had been this increase in participation and because young girls and women were having access to high-quality sports at a much younger age than ever before Title IX was passed, we were falling into this trap that sports was seen as this oppositional gendered binary, meaning we had women's sports and men's sports, and never, ever would there be any intersection. And that one of the reasons given for that, you know, sort of a culturally embedded assumption, is that sex segregating sports was all about protecting women. And what I began to realize is that no, sex segregating sports wasn't about protecting women, it was about protecting men. Because sports had been so long identified not just with men, but with maleness and masculinity as biologically based, meaning it wasn't this backroom conspiracy where males were taking all of the resources and shutting women out. It was just, this was the natural order. This was what God intended. This was about biology and physiology. So what's a guy to do by monopolizing this incredibly powerful, ubiquitous institution called sports? And so the assumption was that because we had this gendered binary, that all male athletes by definition would be better than all female athletes. And I remembered, I live in the Twin Cities, meaning Minneapolis, St. Paul. And every year, the Twin Cities Marathon goes by my house where I live. And what I was aware of is that the marathon is one sport where males and females, although they're not competing head-to-head, technically, because we've separated this into men's sports, men's race and women's race, I would see men and women really competing on the same day, on the same course, in the same sport at the same time. And one of the things that I was aware of is that my friends around me, again, all well-meaning, were saying, isn't it great that every year this one single gender gap, meaning the best men who cross the finish line versus the best women who cross the finish line, that gap every year in terms of the time, the overall time it took to complete the race, was narrowing. And I thought that was a really interesting gender comparison, Nicole. But what I also was aware of is that we made that gender comparison, meaning the front-running man, and how he's compared throughout the race to the front-running woman. But the minute that that first woman crossed the finish line, those gender comparisons stopped, meaning that we didn't compare that first woman who ended the marathon to all of the many hundreds and thousands of males who finished behind her. So because we had what I call the selective gender comparison, the take-home message was, even though we had just witnessed the best running females outperform the vast majority of males in the same sport, in the same race, on the same course, on the same day, at the same time, we only compared her to the men who beat her versus all the men that she had just beaten.
Which might be 40 men at the most. Maybe less.
Yes, versus literally thousands of men, or certainly hundreds of men who were elite, but behind her. And the reason, and by the way, I'm not saying that we shouldn't privilege those 30 to 40 men over her in terms of who were the best overall runners. But my point was is that because of this very deeply culturally embedded selective gender comparison, the key takeaway, or the punchline, if we only do the first comparison, is that no matter how good a woman is, she can never beat a man. Yet the key take-home message to the second gender comparison is that some women can beat almost all men. And so what I realized was that sport, far from being this oppositional gendered binary, what we really have when we talk about sport performance is a continuum of performance in which men and women are up and down the continuum. Now, it is true that on average in the sports, as Mike Messner has pointed out, most privilege where males on average have a physiological or physical advantage, meaning sports like football, males dominate. But there are many other sports where women could compete and should compete, and yet we're told that they can't because we need to protect them. And so I started to see sport as a continuum. And again, the issue for me, the key takeaway, is that sex segregating sports protects the interests of men, not women, because if men were really vastly superior athletically in all sports, then they would simply let women compete against them, they would crush them, and that would be the end of it. So why is there such fierce resistance to having men and women compete with each other and foreseeing sport for what it really is, which is a continuum rather than a gendered oppositional binary?
I'm Megan Kahn, host of the We Coach podcast. Every 2 weeks, I chat with female coaches, administrators, or industry experts from a variety of sports across the country. Be sure to tune in every other Thursday on your favorite podcast player for inspiring conversations. I'll see you there.
So, Dr. Kahn, how do you think about this? Because one of the logical questions, I'm sure you get this one a lot, is about this idea of the continuum. So then, are you arguing for the fact that we shouldn't have men's sports and women's sports. We just have sport and everybody competes. And wouldn't that disadvantage women? I mean, how do you counter that argument? Because I've heard people ask you that.
Well, I think, and I actually even wrote this into the paper in 1995 and since then in terms of some follow-up analyses. Yes, it is absolutely the case, as you suggest, and I have been asked this repeatedly, that the logical extension or conclusion of my arguing that we should see sports as a continuum rather than an oppositional binary is that we would get rid of gender, and we would have, for example, at the University of Minnesota, one basketball team, one hockey team. And if we did something, you know, if we did something like that, the very people whose interests we want to protect and advance, meaning women, would be hurt by that. And in the short term, that's absolutely true. There's no question that that's true because men have had an enormous advantage over women in terms of sports. But if you look 100 years ago, if we were looking back 100 years ago and said, in 100 years, girls and women would be participating in all kinds of sports and physical activity, including sports like basketball and hockey. There would be professional leagues for girls and women. People would look at you 100 years ago the way that they would look at me now when I talk about eliminating gender. So what I would argue is that until young girls grow up wanting to be the best basketball player or the best baseball player, rather than the best girls basketball player or girls softball player, we will not make the changes that we need to make. And I would argue that in sports like baseball, where it's not all about physical strength and size and about physically overcoming your opponent by force, that women could make marks in baseball. And that would be the kind of sport that I would see where women could finally penetrate that sacred all-male space.
You know, what's interesting about that comment, Dr. Kane, is that baseball is, to your point, if women could penetrate and infiltrate baseball because of the characteristics you just described, you know, we're seeing women sort of trickling into other professional spaces, but baseball has been really hotly protected. And maybe it's because of that very reason, is that if we actually did allow women in that space with the men may be surprised at how good the women are and may be equals in that space.
Yes, and I think that that's the other reason why there's been such a push to have women basically be confined to softball. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that there's anything wrong with softball, and that if women want to play softball, and men, then that's exactly what they should do. But there's a reason why we don't have two baseball teams at the college level, like we do have two hockey teams, two basketball teams, two swimming teams, two track teams, two golf teams. Why don't we have two baseball teams? Or you know, and that I would think after a generation or two, if we did, that would be a sport where we could merge. Because again, if you look at unlike football or even basketball, where it's not about overall strength and size and physical aggressiveness, there are many baseball players in today's world where there are a lot of women who are just as big and just as strong as many men who play currently professional baseball. And I think you're right. That is, nobody says this out loud or even consciously, but I think that's precisely why men's baseball is absolutely sex segregated, especially at the professional and Division I level.
Yeah, because I just ran into Justine Siegel at the ESPNW summit last week, and you know, she's in this women's baseball space, and a lot of people don't even realize that there are a lot of women and girls that play baseball. And it's not just Monet Davis, a one-off that was in the Little League World Series and we see her on TV. There are thousands of girls and women that play baseball, but you never hear about them.
Yeah, but that's because, again, when it's time for them to go to high school or college, which is where we have serious sports, meaning housed within our educational institutions, those teams don't exist. There's just a boys' baseball team and a girls' softball team. So they get shunted into softball, even if they don't want to, because that's their only option to continue to play something like baseball. And there are scholarships available for them. That's not the case in baseball.
Yeah, that's true. So, Dr. Kane, there's so many things I want to ask you about. And I think what I'd like to do is have you back on the podcast, and we'll talk more about your sport media line of research and, you know, your advice on how to be a public scholar, because there's so much rich knowledge that I think our listeners would love to hear directly from you. So keeping that in mind, that we'll have you back on for, you know, take two on Dr. Kane. Let's continue with this line around the continuum, because the issue of trans athletes right now, with policy development and the numbers of young people that are coming up through the ranks who are transitioning, whether male to female or female to male. I know that you've gotten some questions around how trans athletes fit into this idea of your sport continuum, and how that's sort of relevant and applicable to the current discussion around fairness and inclusion of transgender athletes, particularly male to female trans athletes, which is usually what gets everybody riled up in terms of fairness and inclusion. So can you just speak to that a little bit in terms of how your continuum, sport as a gender continuum, helps us maybe understand how trans athletes are literally contested terrain?
Yeah, now, to be fair to trans athletes and the whole issue, this is a little bit, you know, outside of my comfort zone. And obviously, when I wrote this paper in 1995, the issue of trans athletes just wasn't even on the radar screen. But I do think what's important to understand about this is that because we have historically, both in terms of ideologically and then how we practice sports in this country or around the world, to see sports based upon, again, an oppositional gendered binary, where we divide sports up as a function of one's gender, male or female, what then happens to the notion of sport as a continuum in which males, traditional males and traditional females are, you know, perform across that continuum? What do we do then with trans athletes who blow the doors off the very notion of sex and gender as this oppositional binary? That what we see is that there are all kinds of definitions and all kinds of fluidity, and where then do these athletes fit along the continuum? I think the other issue in play, as you pointed out, is that there's a lot more cultural anxiety from when someone who is theoretically born male decides that he wants to transition to become a she, again, in more traditional gendered terms, that is somehow seen as unfair to the women against whom this person will be competing. Because, again, the assumption is if you're male, by definition, you are a superior athlete and certainly superior over females. So again, how does that change the definition of physical superiority, of athletic superiority? And that's why you have this cultural anxiety about male to female in ways that you simply don't from female to male, because if there's suspicion and surveillance around those biological and physiological changes, we certainly, I'm being stereotypic here, but we certainly aren't going to be threatened by a female who wants to try to become a pretend male.
Back to this idea of trans athletes as contested terrain, especially male to female, and how that, how the women's sport community is navigating this debate and this discussion. There's wildly divergent opinions on who should be included and under what conditions. And I think this idea of the gender continuum is an interesting one to map onto that discussion.
Yes, I think that as well. But so, for example, and especially as a younger generation basically is saying to old fogies like myself, and maybe even to you too, Nicole, which is
probably,
you know, that gender is a performance and gender is fluid, and I don't want to be defined by my gender or my sex. And some days I might want to perform as male, and some days I might want to perform as females or as neither. So what then do you do in terms of athletic performance if a someone who has been typed as biologically, physiologically male at birth says, I feel like I'm trapped inside a woman's body, and so I want to present and perform as female, and yet I'm not going to do anything I'm not going to take hormones, I'm not going to suppress testosterone, I'm not going to increase estrogen, I'm simply going to live my life as a female, and thus I want to claim that identity, and I want to therefore perform in women's sports, and yet I'm still a man, quote unquote, physiologically, biologically. I mean, I just think we are in a brave new world, and I can assure you that this was something I never even contemplated when thinking about sport as a gendered binary. But I think the key takeaway, or the, you know, take home, is that the very notion of sex and gender as this mutually exclusive binary, forget about sports, has just been, the doors have been blown off. And what do we do with that as a society? And quite frankly, I'm glad I'm not an athletic administrator who has to make those decisions, because I want to be fair and I want people to self-identify and have agency. But, you know, I just have no idea where this is headed. Stay tuned. It'll be very interesting.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And there's, you know, you've got the scientific side, which we're getting more data as we speak. You've got the policy side, you've got cultural and societal gender norms coming into play. You've got certainly a lot of people's opinions on this. And I think as we move forward, it's going to be, you know, 5-10 years from now, how this plays out will be interesting, because it's happening in real time, right in front of us. And as, you know, people and scholars that care deeply about gender and sport, we're sort of on the front line of this. And I'm getting asked this all the time. So I think we're not there in terms of a policy statement yet. I don't think anybody is, that because it's complicated and nuanced.
It's very complicated and nuanced, is absolutely the way to think about it. And that's, you know, it's like, I really do not know how to move forward. I just know that we have to. And I think that we have to be fair, and we have to be respectful of human agency and human dignity to figure out what's the best way forward.
Yes, agree. And unfortunately, I think in this debate that sort of guiding principle also for some people conflicts with the idea of what's fair and right and just. So you've got these two kind of basic human principles that are clashing up against one another, which makes this a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I agree.
So Dr. Kane, I hope that you will accept my invitation to come back on and talk more about your other various lines of your research and public scholarship in future versions of Tucker Center Talks.
I would be more than delighted to, and thank you for doing this, because I think it's another way in which we can reach out to a much broader audience beyond the walls of higher education.
I agree. So for the listeners, stay tuned. We will have Dr. Mary Jo Kane, founder and first director of the Tucker Center, back on future versions of Tucker Center Talks. And if you have a particular topic that you would like Dr. Kane and I to discuss on Tucker Center Talks, please let us know. So just in summary, to wrap it up, you have heard from Professor Mary Jo Kane, who has lived the mission of the Tucker Center of making a difference in the lives of girls and women in sports.
Hi, I'm Nia Tapper, a proud WIS ambassador and a USA women's rugby player. I support WIS because they give a platform for women in sports to share their stories, celebrate the accomplishments of other women, and to empower the world through sport. I think it's important to turn up the volume on women's sports, because women are amazing, they are unstoppable, and they are capable of any and everything, and the world needs to know that. My name's Nia Tapper. You can follow me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Nia Tapper, NayaTapper. Thanks for listening and supporting WISP.
I'd love to hear from you. So tweet us at Tucker Center, or you can tweet me directly at Dr. Sports Psych. Please check out our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on Facebook or Instagram. We are on social media. You can find the show notes with the links and the resources for this episode at wispsports.com. Look for Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab. You'll find a lot more conversations from the world of women's sports at WISP Sports website as well. So follow them on social media at WISP Sports. Please share and follow frequently and often. You can also reach us via email with any questions or comments or suggestions to info@wispsports.com. Thank you for listening, and help us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for episode 2 of Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time for another episode. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sports.